quote from the English language edition of the Marx and Engels collected works, which introduces the German ideology in the following way, in a way that I guess gives you a sense of how important the importance that has been placed on the text in terms of understanding Marxism per se. So according to the English language edition of the Marx and Engels works, they say, "It was in the German ideology that the materialist conception of history, historical materialism, was first formulated as an integral theory." So, according to most accounts, this is where the German ideology is Marx proper. This is where the break happens. This is where he, leaves behind his humanist, early Feuerbachian tendencies and becomes the Marx that we all love and care about. Now, there's so much to say about this particular work, the German ideology. There's a million different ways you could approach it. Within it, you do find the kernels of Marxist theory, of history, of consciousness, and of ideology. But I guess the case that I want to make is that first and foremost, we should see it as a transitional work. It was a way in which Marx settled accounts with his own particular political and philosophical ideas, and most importantly, settling accounts with his contemporaries. So I think we should see it as a political intervention that was intended to address the impasse of the young Hegelians that reflected the broader historical impasse of the class that the young Hegelians were the philosophical expression of. So a few correctives to start, about this particular work. Marx and Engels never wrote a book called The German Ideology. You can all go home now. It was never written as a complete work, the fact that we even think of a book called The German Ideology is something that it was transposed on the text almost 100 years later. It's a collected publication of a series of polemics against the young Hegelians, and I think understanding it as a series of essays, as a series of polemics, is important because then we can see the work, rather than being the integral theory of historical materialism, as a particular political intervention at a certain juncture in the development of class struggles in Marxist time. So contrary to popular belief, it was not written to lay out a theory of historical materialism. In fact, Marx never even uses the term historical materialism, and definitely not dialectical materialism. That's not to say that these are not terms that are useful for us, but I think it's worthwhile saying that this is not something that Marx said. So I think we can't hope to understand these texts without some understanding of what Marx and Engels were doing at the same time. So in the same 12 months that they wrote the German Ideology, the so-called mature work, you also had the 1844 manuscripts, you had the German Ideology, and various essays of political economic critique. I think we've got to see each of these works as sort of representing a particular moment of Marx's political and theoretical emphasis, and it's only that way that you can understand why so many different texts all have a different emphasis. So we can't actually see the German Ideology as being a definitive version of Marxism any more than we can as any of these other texts. And the reason why we do think of it, give it an elevated importance, I think there's a historical reason for that, which I'm going to come back to. So I guess one of the things I'm going to try to do with this talk is offer something of a corrective to the way in which the importance that's been placed on this text in terms of understanding Marxism. I think that the German Ideology has, unfortunately, the dominant readings of the German Ideology have tended towards presenting a type of Marxism that is technologically deterministic and reductionistic, both for the people who are advocates of Marxism and for people who want to reject Marxism or criticise it. These readings often ignore the important political, historical context of the texts of these essays, and, you know, there's classic quotes that you see pulled out again and again that are supposed to be definitive accounts of what was only later called historical materialism. Out of these readings, what I think emerges first and foremost, something I want to take up in this talk, is an incomplete conception of both materialism and idealism. According to this narrative, Hegel was, the idealist philosopher. What did that mean? That meant that he didn't think that real things existed. He thought that the world itself was born in the head of the philosopher. Marx, the genius that he was, came along, pointed to material reality. Don't you know that gravity exists? That was sort of the revolution in thought that gave us Marxism. Now, this caricature, I think, does both thinkers a great disservice. One of the arguments I hope to get across is that without Hegel and without seriously understanding Hegel, Marx would have been unable to navigate the young Hegelians, the philosophers of his own time, and in so doing supersede Hegel himself. And I also want to argue that Marx's break with Hegel was not pivoted on a distinction between idealism and materialism, or at least how these sort of poles are traditionally understood. All right, so a little bit about the history of how we came to have a book called The German Ideology. So there's four phases to the publication of The German Ideology. The first phase was the publication of essays by the German SPDs, Franz Mehring, in 1902. Their publication was basically prompted by a desire by German social democracy to better understand the debates in social democracy in Marx's time. So they were seen in context as a way to try to figure out those debates. That was in 1902. The second phase was what we could call the Reconstruction, where the book became a book. This was done by David Ryazanov, and culminated in a complete publication in 1932. So it was under Ryazanov that you get the label of Chapter 1 for the chapter on Feuerbach. This is despite the fact that that chapter was never intended for publication, and the fact that Marx and Engels subsequently refer to it pretty dismissively. So I think, you know, in terms of understanding why it is that at this particular time that you came to have a book called The German Ideology, and, you know, that was supposed to be a decisive account of historical materialism, there are, you know, people can comment on their own theories about why this happened, but I think it's compelling that it was at a time when Marxism was becoming a state religion, it was becoming dogma, the idea that it was scientific, that you could refer to particular texts to understand Marxism as something decisive and integral. You know, this coincided with sort of with Stalinism, and I think that gave that project a particular necessity. And I think, you know, the fact that the particular materialism that came out of the reading led itself to historical determinism, I think was something that was also gelled very well with Stalinism. Now, that's not to say that Ryazanov was a Stalinist. He wasn't. But the book that he put together is essentially one that was picked up by the Stalinists in 1955. This is when the German ideology was reworked and republished following a cleansing of the text. This publication denied its fragmentary nature and presented it as a complete work, historical materialism in one text, so to speak. So the next phase is the 1960s, where you have the publication of what most people would be familiar with, the Arthur publication, which is a critical edition that has an introduction that actually says, well, this is fragmentary, this was polemical, there are things that are missing, you can't see this as an integral text. There's actually the current project for the publication of the MIGA, the collected works of Marx and Engels. It's only now that they're starting to publish these fragments as fragments without offering any sort of overarching narrative for them. And the most significant changes in this new edition is lengthy sessions on Stirner and the true socialists, which I'll try to say a little bit about. So a little bit of historical context, first of all, for Marx and Engels and what they were doing at this time. Both Marx and Engels were born in the German Rhineland. This was a province of Prussia, but it's important to say that Napoleon's armies occupied it until 1914. It was heavily influenced by the ideas of the Russian Revolution and ferment the ideas of revolution and upsurge and the French model, especially, that they sort of witnessed. So because of Germany's economic and political backwardness, what had been acted out in France, Marx and Engels thought really only was reflected in philosophy in Germany. So Marx saw the young Hegelians with their philosophy as the expression of the impetus and cowardice of the German middle class. And a lot of the vitriol in the German, you really get a sense of the vitriol in the German ideology because of that backwardness and that inability to progress along with their neighbour. So France had their bourgeois revolution while Germany was still under the rule of an authoritarian monarch. Not even a nation, but a collection of city-states held together by arcane bureaucratic structures. As Marx later put it, in politics, the Germans have thought what other nations have done. So these were, you know, these young Hegelians were Marx's milieu. They were politically motivated but limited intellectuals that absorbed the ideas of Hegel in very contradictory ways. So you had the conservative wing of the young Hegelians who interpreted Hegel's ideas, basically interpreted the status quo as the embodiment of Hegelian philosophy. The Prussian state represented the culmination of world history. In contrast to this, the radical young Hegelians rejected this as absurd. They used the emphasis on change and transformation in Hegel to emphasize democratic reforms and the necessity to fight for democratic reforms. I think it's important to say, and Marx also recognizes this, that the young Hegelians, both philosophically, never managed to really supersede Hegel. They more embodied different contradictions, I think, in his thought. So the first thing, as I've said, that we need to note about the German ideology is that it was a polemic. It was Marx's frustration in a couple of hundred pages. And I think there's so many excellent quotes you can pull out that gives you a sense of Marx's frustration. You know, this is kind of like, you know, if you think you're frustrated with the Australian political situation, maybe you can relate to some of this. But I love this quote. I think it's excellent. He says, "As we hear from German ideologists, Germany in the last few years has gone through an unparalleled revolution. The decomposition of the Hegelian philosophy, which began with Strauss, has developed into a universal ferment into which all the powers of the past are swept. In the general chaos, mighty empires have arisen only to meet with immediate doom. Heroes have emerged momentarily, only to be hurled back into obscurity by bolder and stronger rivals. It was a revolution beside which the French Revolution was child's play, a world struggle beside which the struggles of Diadochi appear insignificant. Principles ousted one another. Heroes of the mind overthrew each other with unheard of rapidity. And in the years 1842 to 45, more of the past was swept away in Germany than at any other time in three centuries. All this is supposed to have taken place in the realm of pure thought." So this is what clearly what Peterson and Žižek thought they were doing. And if you've watched the debate, they definitely have it. Banality upon banality. But anyway, Marx was pissed off. I think Marx is often portrayed as having come to his revolutionary understanding of the world through a critique of Hegel's idea of the philosophy of the state. But I think biographically, it's actually what the way he came to some of his key breakthroughs was rubbing his nose against key aspects of political and social life, which he encountered as the one of the editors of Rheinische Zeitung. That's right, the Rheinische Zeitung. And most importantly, I think between 1843 and 1844, there were three events that were very significant for Marx. The first was the suppression of the Rheinische Zeitung by the king. There was a move towards authoritarianism, the king tried to repress it, and the response of, Marx's contemporaries, rather than fighting and asserting themselves, they basically accommodated, basically said, well, we need to make our criticisms more, we won't criticise the monarch as much, but please let us keep our journal. And Marx was appalled by this. He thought this was cowardly and ridiculous. At the same time as this, you had the Silesian weavers uprising in 1843, which is the picture that I started with. It was an uprising by workers in Germany, the first example of sort of workers in a situation of exploitation, rising up, not only taking on their employers, but the might of the armed German state. That was significant for Marx. At a time when he saw the middle class cowering, he saw the working class as rising up. And the other significant thing is that he moved to Paris, where he met with an actual radicalizing workers' movement and where he met Engels. So to actually talk about the book itself now, in the edited version of the German ideology, the first chapter is called is on Feuerbach. Now, obviously, in the original, this is not this is not called Chapter One, but I think it's worthwhile talking about Feuerbach because his influence on Marx is pretty undeniable. So, in a letter to Feuerbach in 1844, Marx commended him for having provided the philosophical basis for socialism of greater significance than the whole of contemporary German literature put together. And then he ends the letter really beautifully by saying, "And I love you." It's really nice. So, you know, mental, you know, Feuerbach meant a lot to Marx. Who was Feuerbach? He was a prominent German philosopher. He started out as a student of Hegel in the 1830s, and his views were kind of, to put it, you know, in a couple of words, humanist, atheist, and materialist. Feuerbach developed his philosophy as a way to critique religion, which is what all the young, you know, religion was a big topic. All the young Hegelians were critiquing religion, but also idealism. Feuerbach pointed out that there were similarities between religion and idealism. He thought that both idealist tendencies and religious worldviews situate truth as existing outside humankind. Therefore, idealism hadn't managed to transcend a theological worldview. According to him, Hegelianism was the last remnant of a theological worldview. So he said the essence of theology is the transcendence of exteriorized essence of man. The essence of Hegel's logic is transcendent thought, exteriorized human thought. So in contrast to this, theology, Feuerbach argued that philosophy should begin with the finite or the concrete. The starting point for Feuerbach, classical materialism, is the primacy of immediate experience via our senses. This classically materialist position argues that thought arises from being. Being does not arise from thought. So first we are, and then we kind of think, I guess. So Feuerbach argued that the objects of our sort of, and you know, it was an insightful critique of religion, because what he understood was that the objects of religious contemplation or worship were nothing more than projection of fundamentally human characteristics and values. So he inversed the relationship between humanity and religion. In his book, The Essence of Christianity, he shows that every feature of God is in fact a feature of humankind. So that God, you know, the idea that God is all-knowing is actually just a reflection of the fact that we place value on thought and intellect. The fact that, you know, if God is kind, it is because we are kind. If God is love, it's because we value love. So he said the transcendental world is nothing more but a wishful imagination. It's the outward projection of our inward nature, of our humanity. You know, and he says that basically the study of religion is actually religious study is actually anthropology. Through studying religion, we can learn about ourselves. He says theology is anthropology. Now, Feuerbach's philosophy, as I said, consists of making concrete man the starting point. For true liberation to come about, to be liberated from these conceptions of the world, all we have to do is sort of mentally overcome at the fetishization of these values and recognize our collective humanity in the things that we worship. Take back love, kindness, thoughtfulness, and other values, and realize that they are part of our humanity. Now, this raises the problem, of course, of what is concrete man. If as soon as you attempt to define a concrete individual, I think you actually run into a series of abstractions. If you take away, you take away class, religion, nationality, and any other determinations that sort of we think of when we think of a particular individual, you're really left with nothing, or at least he's not left with anything concrete, nothing concrete at all. And looking at human history, if you just take humanity throughout human history and try to abstract values, you could just as easily say that evil is the essence of humanity, just as good is. It's not the case that one outweighs the other. While Feuerbach made some inroads into, you know, he had a conception of species being and something that was human, and a partial overcoming of a theological worldview, it wasn't a view of humanity that it could account for historical change, or that could account for how to change things in the here and now. I'll come back to say a bit about what sort of Marx said about this after I talk about Stirner, because I think Marx's critique of both Feuerbach and Stirner, there was a common thread to both of them. So the section on Max Stirner, or as Marx called him, Saint Stirner, Saint Max, is probably the lengthiest part of the original manuscript, in both theoretical and political terms. And it's the section, obviously, that most people haven't read. I think understanding Stirner is important because it's in dealing with Stirner is where Marx and Engels first developed their conception of ideology. and in understanding ideology, and it's where they start to introduce, I think, some of their conclusions out of the critique of political economy to a kind of philosophical application. And Stirner's influence on Marx has also been underestimated. This is reinforced by the fact that it's left out of the edited version. But as David McLellan argues, which I find compelling, Marx engaging with Stirner after Feuerbach was important for Marx's own development from Feuerbach. So depending on how you read Stirner, you can find one of, you know, the world's first, world's first anarchist. A lot of these things kind of sound anarchist-y. Sections of it are reminiscent of Jordan Peterson as well. It's pretty, although that's doing a disservice to Stirner. I don't want to draw a comparison. But basically, again, in an attempt to overcome the theological worldview, Stirner argued that basically the whole problem with Feuerbach and others like him was that, you know, and the true socialists as well, that we'd replace religious causes with new, kind of like non-religious causes. Like, so instead of worshipping love, we're now told that we're meant to value humanity or love or truth, or, you know, these are abstract values that, can be just as dominating and, sort of presiding above us as religious idols can be. So he argues that this isn't really overcoming the theological worldview. He says that all these ideas were really just manifestations of the holy and should therefore be rejected. For Stirner, humanity was just as much an abstraction as God. And the only real, what is real, what he was sure of, is the individual. The only thing to really follow that you should listen to is ego. And specifically, of course, as is usually the case, his own ego, which he saw as superior to the rest. He says, only I am not an abstraction. So wrote A History of Humanity, and it really it's a kind of chronicle of society's enslavement to abstracted ideals. He shows how throughout the whole of human history, we've been enslaved by various ideals and worshipped false idols. And the issue with this is the whole of human history is presented as variations in consciousness, different ideas that we've been enslaved to and have been dominated by. And the solution, similarly, is a change in consciousness, a redirection of attention and affection away from these ideals towards the ego. And as Marx and Engels pointed out, this sort of conceptual movement, what it does is it essentially leaves the real world intact. So in his book, The Ego and Its Own, Stirner writes, "The state owes its existence only to the contempt which I have for myself, and with the disappearance of this disdain, it will totally die out." So for Stirner, the conception of ideology, this leads on to the question of the similarities between Stirner and Feuerbach. For Stirner, ideology is domination from outside. We have to reject abstractions because they are not human and they are not our own. We should revert our attention to our ego. For Feuerbach, if Stirner's the first anarchist, then Feuerbach is probably the first hippie. For Feuerbach, he basically says, well, for Feuerbach, it's these abstractions are humanity. We should embrace them as our own. Again, both of them sort of at the level of a moving consciousness. I think both begin with the individual and succumb in what Marx describes in his thesis on Feuerbach to the ideological pitfalls of a perspective of the individual. For Feuerbach, he takes humanity, a collection of abstracted individuals. For Stirner, he takes one individual, specifically his own ego. And I think neither of them can really comprehend the way in which ideology and the ideas, the representations of the world, actually correspond to history as a set of empirically given social relations. The way in which Stirner and Feuerbach may seem like they're at opposite ends of the ideological spectrum, but they occupy the same subject position. They occupy the position of a passive ethical standpoint. Both see overcoming alienation as a conceptual movement, and both see redirecting consciousness as being the way to do this. Both leave the real world as something intact, and thereby both end up positing some sort of a utopia. And this is where I think Marx's critique owes something to how he read Hegel. The critique of the ethical standpoint and utopianism is central to Hegel, and in turn, I think, is central to Marx's critique of the young Hegelians. So I guess this involves a bit of a discussion of some of Hegel's key ideas. So one of the phrases in Hegel from the philosophy of right that has led to a lot of confusion is the idea, or the quote, what is rational is real, and what is real is rational. Now, this is often taken as a rationalization of the status quo. This means you need to accept things the way it is. It's been pitted as like, this is the origin of Hegel. This is where you can see Hegel's conservatives coming out. But I think there's another way in which this can be read that is more insightful. A radical reading of Hegel, I think, would posit that politics needs to concern itself with the actual, with the truth of a case, with things as they actually are. Basically, to be able to grasp a concrete situation, it's important to articulate the relationship between what is happening at the moment and the developments and tendencies within that situation towards something else. There has to be a reconciliation between what is and what ought to be. So the limitation of and the limitations of abstract ethical standpoints, like the kinds that I've described by Stirner and Feuerbach, is key to Hegel's critique of Kant's moral philosophy. He argues that you can't just posit abstract ethical values on the world, and that critique has to start from the, from what actually exists. And this is, I think, precisely the method that Marx adopts in the German ideology. His whole understanding of communism, I think, is something that is based on an immanent critique. For both Marx and Hegel, the real, or the actual, was not something that was just a set of empirical data. I think, Marx emphasizes the empirical nature of his investigations, but even as he describes them, even as he says that it's an empirical account, he's actually producing an account that is heavily indebted to Hegel. In contrast to Feuerbach, he emphasizes social being as opposed to just being, and I think this distinction is important, and he also distinguishes between appearance and essence. His analysis doesn't appear but begin with isolated facts, the decisions of great men, or dates, and the ideas that seem to drive history. Rather, his account starts from social relations that underpin people, ideas, and institutions that make up empirical history. And as we heard in the last session on Capital, he actually moves from the abstract to the concrete. He begins with Capital as an abstraction to then to begin to understand empirical history. So within this, it's in this way that he's able to describe a situation that is contradictory and in constant movement, a reality that within itself actually contains the possibility of its own destruction. And as Marx says in the German ideology about communism, communism is for us not a state of affairs which is to be established, an ideal to which reality will have to adjust itself. We call communism the real movement which abolishes this present state of things. The conditions of this movement result from the premises now in existence. So I guess this leads on to where do ideas fit into Marx's conception of history? You can't read the German ideology without getting a strong sense of Marx's contempt for what he calls the idealist view of history. The idea that revolutions in ideas or philosophy are the motive for progress. He mocks the young Hegelians, Stirner, Feuerbach, and Bauer, for their notion that ideas are the origin of all that is wrong with the world. The idea that we created wrong conceptions and then we created a distorted reality. And again, I think this is where it's important to make a distinction between Hegel himself and the young Hegelians that took after him. Because Hegel himself, I think, also thought nothing of the kind, that that reality is born in the head of the philosopher. So Hegel mocks the idea that reality, that thought precedes reality, in quotes such as this. From the Encyclopedia of Logic. He says, assertions such as these, that ideas precede activity, would be the equivalent of the contention that we would be incapable of eating before we have acquired familiarity with the chemical, botanical, or zoological properties of our nutrients, and that we would have to wait to digest until we finished the study of anatomy or physiology. Now, you compare this to, you know, a similar kind of quip in Marx's German ideology, where he says, "Once upon a time, a valiant fellow had the idea that men were drowned in water only because they were possessed with the idea of gravity," etc. Now, you could have an argument about which critique is more cutting, but I think the idea, the criticism, I think shares a lot in common. Now, so that, you know, I think in terms of also the relationship between thought and being is something that there is a lot in more in common that is often recognized. So Hegel articulates, Hegel articulates the relationship between thought and being in the following way. "The content that fills our consciousness, of whatever kind it may be, makes up the determinacy of feelings, intuitions, images, representations, and of thoughts and concepts. Feeling, intuition, and image are in this respect the forms of such a content." Now, my reading of this, of what he means by content, is history. Content is human activity as it changes and transforms the world. And for Hegel, form and content can be conceptually distinguished, but these are not. This is not something that can be that is distinct. So Marx had to respond to Stirner's argument that abstractions were just oppressive fictions, basically had to show how these were historically determined. To show how they were historically produced was to be the basis for how they could be overthrown. To put it in the words of Hegel, he had to reveal the content that created the basis for the forms of representation. And for this, begins his engagement with historical analysis that was heavily influenced by political economy. He had to study history in a way that could start to actually see its underlying dynamics. And with that, he had to begin with production and the production and reproduction of everyday life, social relations, and the organization of labor. So to get to the root of the problem of abstractions or ideology, Marx didn't just take sort of empirical facts about society. He had to assess empirical material itself as abstractions and move beyond this to reveal underlying and more complex and dynamic, but hardly material in the way we normally think about it, social relations. Abstractions, you know, so you take abstractions like the individual, the state, the law, and start to see, well, what are the actual relationships that underpin these things in society? And this method was important for Marx's critique of Stirner. So like many anarchists, Stirner saw the state as the enemy because it oppresses individuals. Marx also began his critique of Hegel at the moment of the state, but actually the way he understood this at the state was in relation to what were the economic laws governing bourgeois society, not as something the state as something that could be analysed on its own terms by reading constitutions or laws or whatever. So Marx and Engels, I guess, they view Hegel's most abstract statements in light of concrete history, whereas in contrast to this, the young Hegelians, like Stirner, took up the most abstract ideas to be the real motor of history. Marx says in the German ideology, he says, "The premises from which we begin are not arbitrary ones, not dogmas, but real premises from which abstraction can only be made in the imagination. They are the real individuals, their activity, and the material conditions under which they live, both those which they find already existing and those produced by their activity." So in 20, 30 pages, a pretty phenomenal sort of history of everything in the German ideology, Marx explores the relationship between the means and relationships of production and historical development, population growth, technological innovation, scientific progress. All of these are discussed in terms of the organisation of society, and I don't have time to go through all of that. There's tribal, feudal society, the emergence of private property and capitalism, the division of labour, the division of the population between town and country, manufacturing, big industry. All of this is sort of delved into to try to understand historical progress. And I think it's important to say that, when he's talking about these things, he's not just emphasising production. The whole spectrum of political and social transformation, I think, is taken into account. What you get a taste for is that history is an active life process. It's not, on the one hand, just a series of static, dead facts, and it's also not just the progress of ideas. The process of history involves the satisfaction of and simultaneous production of new needs. Sustenance is not just a, you know, it's not just about sort of sustaining humanity, but about an it's a creative, intellectual, and aesthetic process that involves creative, intellectual, and aesthetic needs being produced and reproduced at the same time. And consciousness actually is it rather than something being determined by material being in some one-to-one way, consciousness is itself a social product. And Marx makes the point that the fact that you can think of consciousness as being just something that happens in the head or something determined by materiality, this is actually itself a product of reification and the fact that there's a division of labor between mental and manual labor. So I guess, you know, the emphasis on production in the German ideology and in other texts, the Holy Family comes to mind, is often posited as evidence of determinism in Marxism. A quote that is cherry-picked by both advocates and opponents of Marxism to show that Marx had broken with his humanist philosophical hang-ups, like alienation and species being, all of that, and that he had moved to, you know, sort of scientific Marxism, is this one. He writes, "We do not set out from what men say, imagine, conceive, but from real active men on the basis of their real life process, we demonstrate the development of the ideological reflexes and echoes of this life process. The phantoms formed in the brains of men have no history, no development, but men developing their material production and their material intercourse alter, along with their actual world, also their thinking and the products of their thinking. It is not consciousness that determines life, but life that determines consciousness." So, you know, it's quotes like this that I think have led to a lot of debate in Marxism about the supposed opposition or antinomy between structure and agency, between necessity and freedom, between determinism and subjectivism, materialism and idealism. And apparently the German ideology is the text that sort of, you know, strengthens the case of, you know, hard materialist Marxism. Now, I actually think that that it's important to emphasise that Marx's discussion of production and labour in the German ideology, it is distinctive from his, you know, from the 1844 manuscripts and earlier works. But I think it's distinctive not because he disposes of the earlier concepts, but because of what he seeks to do and to emphasise in his arguments with the young Hegelians. I think, you know, and this is something people can disagree with in the discussion, I actually think that labour and species being as a philosophical concept is not something that's discarded in the German ideology. Rather, I think Marx recognises that in conditions of alienation, the history that we confront is material precisely in the sense that we're cut off from the constitutive, creative, conscious aspect of our human labour. So the distinction between the materiality of historical development and sort of consciousness as being free, I think this is not so much a metaphysical claim as a recognition of the distorted nature of historical determination as it exists in conditions of alienated labour. And I think the mediation between Marx's conception of historical determinism, you know, in talking about the relations of production, conceived of as a relatively blind process, the connection between that and Marx's conception of historical agency is working class praxis. And to show what I'm talking about, there's a couple of quotes in the German ideology that I think are relevant. So he says, "The social power, the multiplied productive force, which arises through the cooperation of different individuals as is determined within the division of labour, appears to these individuals, since their cooperation is not voluntary but naturally given, not as their own united power, but as an alien force existing outside of them, of the origin and goal of which they are ignorant, which they thus cannot control, and on the contrary passes through a specific series of phases and stages independently of, nay, even governing the will and the action of men." He continues, "The fixation of social activity, this consolidation of our products into a material power above us, human and history growing out of our control, thwarting our expectations, bringing to naught our calculations, is one of the chief aspects in historical development up until now." And I think these quotes in the German ideology sort of illustrate what I'm arguing. So historical determination is an unconscious process. Historical sort of determinism as an unconscious process is something that Marx wants to overcome, not something that Marx sees as eternal. I think Marx's concept of human freedom and flourishing is based on creating a society that knows itself and on making history a conscious process. How are we going for time? Okay, cool. And this, I guess, sort of leads on to the thesis on Feuerbach, which, you know, is a work that he, you know, very, I think, connected theoretically to the German ideology. One of the key transitions that Marx makes between 1843 and 1845 is regarding the role of the proletariat and the relationship between the working class and philosophy. And the shift, I think, is that he starts to conceive of the working class as an active element in social transformation. Whereas before he thought that the working class was the passive mass and that philosophy would provide the ideas, the shift that happens is he starts to see the activity as workers themselves as being transformative. And I think this is another reason why it's important not to see the German ideology as being the sort of an example of, you know, deterministic Marxism or an example of the, you know, if you see determinism and hard materialism as being the evolution, you're missing what is the real evolution and the real development, which is actually towards an emphasis on the agency of the working class and their ability to be transformed through practice. Might cut out. So in contrast to the young Hegelians with their emphasis on consciousness or materiality alone, I think Marx starts to, in this period, Marx starts to posit practice. And he says that actually the opposition between the ideal and the material as embodied in the young Hegelians, this opposition only actually holds up if the question is posed in isolation from actually seeing history and life as a dynamic life process. And this is what he says in the second thesis on the thesis on Feuerbach. He says, the chief defect of all hitherto existing materialism, that of Feuerbach included, is that the thing, reality, sensuousness, is conceived only in the form of the object of contemplation, but not as sensuous human activity, practiced not subjectively. You know, this is a pretty famous quote where Marx settles accounts with both tendencies. Now, in the rest of the thesis on Feuerbach, Marx argues that true understanding, comprehending reality, is only really possible with the adoption of a revolutionary project itself, and it's a project that has to be based on a class that can have an active and practical relationship to the world. He'd identified the limitations of the young Hegelians as embodying the limitations of the German middle class, and that's something that he knew had to be overcome by adopting the perspective of a different class, a class with the potential to transform reality. And I think the significance of this worldview is that it allowed him to overcome the opposition between what seems to exist now and what is possible. And this is where you get to, you know, the famous thesis 11 of the theses, that philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it. Now, this is something that's often understood as, it's Marx breaking with philosophy, starting to be for mindless activity. I think we have to see it as itself a philosophical breakthrough. It was not an argument for practice as opposed to theory. It was actually for a new way of conceptualizing both. So Marx makes the case that your understanding of the world has to actually proceed from the possibility of transforming it. A point that I think owes a lot to Hegel. All right. So just a couple of things to conclude. I think to say that there's problems with saying that, you know, with positing the German ideology as a definitive account of historical materialism is not to say that you can't learn things from it. It's also the argument that I've made in terms of the connections between Marx's early and late work is also not to say that there's not development. There is development, but the development does not stop there. And I think that's important. I think more the point I've been trying to make is that we should avoid elevating it. We shouldn't see it as a replacement for engaging with the philosophy of his early work, the economical analysis of later work. And in most cases, the German ideology is actually an inferior example of both history, economics, and philosophy, precisely because it's a series of polemics. And I guess that's why I've emphasized the polemical aspect and the polemics rather than the accounts of history, because I think they're rather schematic. So I guess given all that I've kind of presented, I think there's something to be said in which for the way in which the early social democrats read Marx's work. There's a way to better understand the debates in German social democracy in Marx's time and the issues that they were grappling with. That's not to say it's irrelevant now, but it's only by understanding them in their context, I think that their truth can be reflected on today. Finally, I don't think I've solved the question of what's the relationship between, what's the position of ideas in Marx. I think that's, it's a complicated one. Are ideas secondary? Yes and no. Was Marx a materialist? Yes and no. He definitely didn't think that ideas reflected reality. His whole critique of ideology actually showed that the complicated relationship between ideas and reality. But at the same time, he didn't just adopt the crude materialism of Feuerbach, which is, with its emphasis on an objective world that we have access to via the senses. Marx recognized that there's a divorce between consciousness and social being, and that this divorce between consciousness and being is actually what makes us and historical societies before us unfree. And as I've emphasized, this is, I think, something that Marx wants to overcome. I think you could say that it's what he sees in terms of communism. It's social being becoming conscious of itself as such, and thereby rendering humanity self-determining. And I think this emphasis on making history a conscious process, I think is a common thread that continues throughout all of Marx's work. So finally, Marx does not abandon philosophy. Rather, I think he wants to create a society in which philosophy is realized and thereby overcome.